Dalton's Comics and Culture Radar, a podcast that's on the lookout for what's good to read and watch. If you don't know who Milton is, let's ask Kiefer Sutherland's father what he thinks.
Don't write this down, but I find Milton probably as boring as you find Milton. He's a little bit long-winded. He doesn't translate very well into our generation, and his jokes are terrible.
This episode, Milton's guest is Frank Martin, a comic book writer. Frank is here to discuss the upcoming comic Polar Paradox, which is now crowdfunding on Kickstarter.
Frank, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Milton, what's up? Thank you for having me.
Oh, man, thank you so much. You're my first recording of 2021, a year that we all have been glad to see roll past our calendar dial.
Absolutely.
So, orient me. You're based in the east side of the country, right? Did you say you're in New York?
Yeah, I'm just outside the city.
Oh, okay, cool. What's living just outside of the city like? I'm somewhat envious of that scenario.
Well, my dad has an expression that his favorite part of New York City is leaving. Everybody's get their. I like living outside the city because I'm like 10-15 minutes away. I can go in, I can get my city fix, do what I need to do, and then I get to go home. You know, I don't have to go to a building and go upstairs to the 20 some odd floor and then have to deal with noise all night long. So, I mean, some people love it. Some people, it's really for them and they're there all the time. But yeah, I love being in the city to do what I need to do, and then I like going to my back home, to my house, and my yard, and my space, and my quiet.
That's great. That sounds pretty ideal to me. I haven't been to New York as frequent as I would like to. Every time I go, I promise to come back more frequently because I just love it when I go. And I'm hoping, if New York Comic Con exists this year, to maybe go. But if it doesn't, I'm definitely going in 2022.
Yeah. One of the things I love is that you're rarely tourists in your own city, you know? Whenever you go visit another city, you want to do all the touristy things. But growing up in the city, you really never take advantage of all that tourist stuff. So especially every once in a while, I mean, it hasn't happened recently, but I like to just do a tourist day in New York City, you know, ride the double-decker bus or go to a museum or Statue of Liberty or Ellis Island or do one of those tourist attractions that draws people here, but the people that actually live here never really get to experience.
Oh, wow. Well, that's definitely cool. So let's dive into your comics work and let's talk about sort of your origin story. How did you come to comics writing?
So I was I still am a prose writer. I kind of got into writing short stories and writing fan fiction, and then I kind of gravitated towards novels and longer work from there. But all during this time growing up, I've always loved comics, you know, love the comics characters and the big two guys. And I wanted to tell stories using those characters, but I don't know, I never really gravitated towards writing actual comic books until it kind of dawned on me one time, I guess during college in my early 20s. I'm like, I love writing stories and I love reading comics. Why don't I just try writing comics? You know, let me just give it a shot. I'm like, I could totally do this. And I quickly found out the steep learning curve that is comic creation. And I've been at it for really consistently for a couple years now. And it's a blast.
I'm smiling. You cannot see this since this is an audio podcast, but the moment you expressed like, hey, I'll just give this a try, I felt a humbling was due in your immediate future, as we all who attempt this medium find out pretty quickly.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has ever said, yeah, I just started writing comics and it was like the easiest thing in the world.
Yeah. And specifically on that, like, give me a narrow writing challenge or area of comics writing that you've had to confront, and maybe you still are confronting it and maybe avoiding it. What are some of the hardest things for you in writing comics?
I think one of the key components that's the hardest, but it's also, I think, what makes comics special is pacing. you know, because when you write a story, it's a fluid story. You're using the reader's imagination to craft a scene. I dabbled in some screenwriting too. It's kind of the same thing. You're writing something that's going to be on film and it's going to be a fluid story. A comics is a static story. You know, it's told in still images, and you really got to have that mindset when you're storytelling, that this is not going to be something that's fluid. When you actually see someone walk across the room, you know, you got to pace it out and you got to time it to let the reader know that this guy's walking across the room. But you can't, comics is all about using resources too, so you can't use a whole page to kind of get that message across. So those two components, you know, resource management and pacing, is what makes comics truly special as far as a storytelling medium.
Yeah, those are unique challenge dimensions of comics writing. So when you do sit down to write a new comic, does inspiration come to you in waves, or do you have a set time and it just comes? How do the muses treat you?
I kind of describe my inspiration process as chaotic. So, I mean, with three kids, and especially now with everybody's schedules just up in the air, our schedules are changing daily. I have to grab inspiration in the moments that I have them, so I can't let them pass, you know? So I really have to, always have a notepad handy. Or always, I write a lot on my phone. Like I just open up a Google email and I just write it. Like if I need a line of dialogue or a scene or whatever, I might just type it up real quick on my phone and then go back to my computer and pull up the draft and I can just see it there, you know, kind of like a Google Drive or whatever. So, yeah, I have no set time. It's very hard to just sit down and say at 8 o'clock, I'm going to make a cup of coffee and write. So it's always dribs and drabs here and there wherever I grab it.
Yeah. You seem to be an ad hoc person when it comes to the productivity and process side of things. Are you constantly evolving your tools and how you do the thing?
Not really. I mean, I'm kind of basic. I don't use any specific writing program. I just make my scripts in Microsoft Word, and I maybe I'm behind the times utilizing all these other fancy stuff. I know a lot of my colleagues that are novelists and authors, they use Grammarly or one of these other programs to kind of help them out. I don't know. I feel like maybe I'm behind the times, maybe a little bit of a Luddite in that I'm just very basic as far as actually making the thing, you know. my big accomplishment was, I would say maybe a year or two ago, I started lettering my own books. So the fact that I'm completely a technical nitwit, that I've kind of sort of have an understanding of how Illustrator works, and that I could do something competent enough on the page that it actually looks like word balloons. That's my big achievement.
Yeah, that's a rite of passage for many writers in comics, for sure, and very eye-opening. I went through the same process. Did you find yourself that there was a phase when I was teaching myself lettering, and I by no means consider myself adept or expert at it. But when I was trying to learn, there was a period when I was reading other comics where I became so obsessed with lettering that I couldn't read comics anymore. I was only looking at the lettering.
Yes, definitely. I mean, lettering is the weirdest art form. It's the only art form that is more successful the least you notice it. You know, it needs to be something that's so seamless with the art that your average reader is just going to accept it as it is without really appreciating it, you know? And it's not until you actually try to attempt lettering yourself that you could stop and be like, that's a great tail on that word balloon, you know? It's the little things.
Yeah, yeah. So as far as a kind of higher scope things beyond just the minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour creation of scripts, what are some of the hardest lessons you've learned in comics so far?
Oh, man. I think just the hardest lesson I've ever learned, not just in comics, but I think in any sort of art creation, is that nobody's going to care about your thing more than you, you know?
Yeah.
I learned that really quick when I went to my first convention and my first signing. And I'm like, this is going to be great. I'm just going to show people stuff and they're just going to stop and they're going to listen to me talk. It really doesn't work out like that. They're not there for you. They're not there to buy indie comics in general. For the most part, they're there for Spider-Man and Batman, or they're there to get their celebrity photo op. And making someone interested in what you are selling or what you're offering or what you're telling is a very steep hill. And once you smack into that face first, you're ready to climb it. You know, it's either you let it run you over and you just get so defeated that you kind of want to stop and not go on anymore, or you kind of rise up to the challenge and you say, I'm going to make everybody really interested in this awesome story, this awesome book that I have. So that was learning that was difficult, to say the least.
Indeed. So you described this interaction in a convention context. Have you had a chance to table at any shows yet?
Like recently?
No. Yeah. The imaginary shows. No. I mean, like, ever.
Yes. I've tabled. I mean, I don't hit the convention scene as much as some of our peers, simply because it's so difficult in my life, getting away from kids and getting away from the regular average mundane stuff that I have going on. But I have definitely tabled at shows. I've learned which ones are cool and people are really into comics and which ones are not, and it's harder to convince people that you got something that's worthy of their time. But I think it's really the best way. You know, when you're kickstarting or you're selling something online, it seems like you're shouting to a void with a whole bunch of other people that are shouting to a void. And there's something about that one-on-one interaction when you look into somebody's eyes and you pitch them your story and they get to physically hold your book in their hands. There's just nothing like it.
Yeah. When that works, it's definitely an amazing experience. And I personally have found that it has calibrated how I approach choosing projects, and everything about those interactions leads me to kind of relearn everything, because I'll go into a specific con with a specific set of books or things that I'm trying to promote at that given moment, and these are my priorities, and I may have a prejudgment about the show, the context of the show, or maybe the type of people that I see coming, like based on what they're wearing or whatever. And invariably, I end up being 100% wrong. Like, the thing that I think people are going to be interested in, no, they want the other thing. And the people that are wearing this shirt that I think will like this book, they don't like that book, they want the other book. And it's constantly an evolving process, and I find it very useful.
I mean, you definitely wear, as a comic creator, so many hats. And when you're just regular comic creation, just the job of it all, and then going to a convention, you have to wear those hats, you know, in real time. You have to be a creator, you have to be a salesperson. You're, in some ways, you're a showman, because you're, in order to grab people's attention, you can't just be sitting behind your table just kind of moping about. You really got to get out there and grab people's attention and be Mr. Charismatic. So it's, you really got to juggle all these things at once in real time as people are walking by you and sizing you up the same way you're sizing them up. So it's almost like the convention dance in a way between you and the fan.
Yeah, and I've told some of my creator friends that one of the fascinating things about the whole thing, a good friend of mine who's a fantastic comic creator, Dave Chisholm, he's got this really laid back approach and a very natural sort of salesmanship to him that doesn't start with sales. It starts with just genuine human interaction. And he's just naturally gifted at that in ways that I'm definitely not, and some of my peers or not. But one of the things I told him and some of my other friends is, it's interesting when you're sitting there and getting a lot of indifference. Normally indifference is like the absence of emotion, but in that context it almost feels like the people are giving off a wave of, I do not judge you worthy. You must not bother me. You know, it's like, receive the signal. The signal is saying, don't bug me. And learning how to detect that signal is part of the game.
You know, it's weird, but when somebody walks by your table or your booth and you go, hey, you want to check out my comic? And they just say no and walk away real fast. For some reason, that's so much better than if they just stop and just talk to you for 5 minutes and then just say, yeah, whatever, and then walk away. It's so much better than them pretending that they're interested just not to hurt your feelings. The big line is, yeah, I'm gonna do a walk around the floor and I'll be back. And he's like, no, you're not gonna be back.
So, Frank, I have a gift for you at the moment. You have a captive audience, that is me, and you have the opportunity right now to pitch me on your latest project. Tell us a little bit about it. The title is Polar Paradox. Give us the quick elevator pitch of the comic.
Polar Paradox is a real simple premise. It takes place in the near future when a bunch of research scientists are exploring an uncharted cave system underneath Antarctica. You get there through the Antarctic Sea, and they go missing. And a trio of rescue divers are sent into this uncharted waters with a whole bunch of animals that nobody's ever seen before in order to rescue them. And then when they reach this undercover cave system, they uncover a mystery that kind of shocks the Earth. So they have to figure it out. And it's an adventure kind of sci-fi mystery that takes place in the near future. That's very similar to shows like Lost in Space or maybe Fantastic Four. You know, those old team adventures of them going off into a new world, a new place, and trying to survive and accomplish their mission.
So, one of the questions I have for you, I don't know how to articulate this, but the Antarctic just naturally seems like a good setting for a story. What drew you to that as a setting?
So this book was inspired by a National Geographic article I read. I read National Geographic religiously. I got a subscription. I read it cover to cover. And this particular story really stood out to me. It was basically about exactly what the book is about, at least the scientist side of things, where you have scientists that dig into the ice and they go diving underwater and they're taking pictures in a place that no human has ever been before. They're taking pictures of animals that evolved on completely different trajectories than any other place on Earth. And I'm like, this is perfect for a sci-fi adventure book. And the story kind of grew from there. And I think there's something about Antarctica because it's such... It's so rigorous, you know, it's so treacherous being there, but at the same time, it's because it's so remote, there's an element of mystery that could just be so cool with it. I mean, forget science fiction. I'm a big fan of the Greg Rucka book. What is it called? Whiteout?
Which
takes place in Antarctica. I was a huge fan of that book, and it's essentially like a crime mystery, like a detective story in a way. It has nothing to do with sci-fi or an adventure, but it's just a great setting for that kind of suspense and thrilling adventure or action, I should say.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned your background information on the National Geographic article, because as I was reading it, it felt very authentic to me. And I've reached a point where I need to re-engage with my love of science. It's been a few years since I've dove back into some, you know, current studies and literature and so forth. And so I feel a bit out of practice. And I was wondering, like, is this just really great speculation, or is this like right on the edge of something that's legit? So I'm glad you told us about the origins of it. When it comes to science, do you have a specific background in that, or is that just a passion or interest?
No, it's just an interest. I just think stuff is cool. Sometimes truth is definitely stranger than fiction, and reading stuff in National Geographic just really kind of scratches that itch for me, because they're telling true stories about things that we've never really encountered before that are so wild. And yeah, this is, I don't want to say all my stories are so heavily rooted in science. I mean, I dabble all over the place as far as the genres that I write, but this definitely, it was birthed from a science article. So that was definitely the direction that I was headed. It takes place in the near future, so I definitely took some liberties with a bunch of the technology that they use for storytelling purposes. You know, they have futuristic suits and a futuristic submarine, but some of the lines and the creatures that come there, I ripped directly from the article. I think that there's a line that says that they tried exploring this place during the winter, but when they cut a hole in the ice to dive, the ice refroze before they had a chance to go in. And that was, that was something I put that in the book. That was something that really was from the article. So I didn't make that up at all. That was kind of a real detail, which I thought was kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah. So, am I right in understanding the structure here, that this is a 2-issue story?
Yeah, this is a 2-part story. The first part really hones in on the adventure side of the story, and then we get a lot more into the mystery side of things with the second part. And Antonio Mastria, who's the artist and co-creator in the book, we leave it off on a possibility of a continuation. So depending on how the Kickstarter for these 2 parts do, we can do a follow-up, another 2-part story that would pretty much wrap everything up and end on a more solid note.
So tell me a little bit about the campaign. I'm thinking the campaign is going to launch either simultaneous or right before this episode drops. So it'll probably be out there. Tell us a little bit about the reward structures and the timeline and those sorts of things.
So it's a campaign will run for 3 weeks from January 12th to February 2nd. I have a standard issue print cover from Antonio that he did. He actually did a connecting cover with part 2. So it's like, imagine a double page spread, a big ensemble piece that we basically cut in half, and part 1 will be one half of that image and part 2 will be the second half, which I think is really, really cool. We're going to have a variant cover available, some prints available. I'm going to take advantage of Kickstarter's Make 100 event that they kind of run every January, and so I'm going to have a reward tier with all the rewards, but the Make 100 reward is going to be a kind of a face mask, kind of a reward for our times. What I did was I took one of Antonio's scrap designs for the helmets for the divers, and it looks like a scuba diver's rebreather face mask, and I used that as a template for the face mask. So if you put it on, it looks like you have a scuba diving mask on. So I think it looks really cool. My son says I look like a Fallout character when I wear it. Cool. My younger son, who's only 3, doesn't know what Fallout is. He says I look like Iron Man. So I guess that's something, I guess. But I thought that was kind of a cool little unique item that I could do for Make 100 that kind of goes with the campaign, you know. So and we offer some commissions. I always, for my campaigns, I always offer a short story commission, like a prose short story. I get super envious and jealous of artists at conventions that can just kind of like put their head down and work on commissions the whole time. So that's kind of why I came up with this commission tier that I offer every single campaign. And I always get 1 or 2 people that grab it, and I get to craft a story for them, which is pretty cool.
So, enlighten me a little bit. I'm woefully ignorant of this Make 100 thing. What is the Make 100 thing?
So Kickstarter wants to promote people to formulate a campaign based on a simplistic item that they only offer 100 of.
Okay.
And the idea is you create a reward and you cap it at 100.
Okay.
And if you put Make 100 in your title, there's certain stipulations you have to do. If you put Make 100 in your title or your subtitle, they'll put a little like Make 100 badge on the project, you know, where it says like Project We Love or Kickstarter or stuff like that. They'll make a special Make 100 badge and they'll put it there. At the end of the day, I don't think it really matters much. I think it's just something to promote activity on the platform. But it's cool and it's something, and I have a campaign in January, so I figured why not try to have some fun with it.
That's cool. Are both of the issues around the same length?
Yes, both the issues. I'm not 100% sure what they both are. I think they're between 20 and 22 pages. The books themselves, I believe, are 24 pages. And issue one is completely finished. So for my previous campaign, the Macabre Motel, I tried something new, which was I placed my printing order the day after the campaign ended. So as everybody knows, Kickstarter is infamous for holding funds for 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the campaign ends, before you get all that money. I wanted to do bang bang fulfillment. I just placed the order as soon as the campaign ended. So the book is print ready. It's ready to go. And as soon as it's done, I can order all the books. And then as soon as I get them, I could start. People could theoretically get their books before I even have the Kickstarter money. So that's kind of how that operates.
And I can vouch for this fact. I've been one of the privileged people who got to see a digital preview of issue one. It's definitely 100% in the can. I enjoyed it a lot. And the early part of our conversation, where you talked about the challenge of pacing, the pacing in the first issue, I think, is one of the strengths of this comic. It really flows at the perfectly natural pace for what it is telling. I don't feel rushed. I don't feel dragged. I feel like every moment counts and leads to what it needs to lead to. And I don't think this is much of a spoiler to say, when you have a two-part story, part one is probably going to end on a somewhat enticing note or a cliffhanger, and it delivers on all of those beats. So hats off to you for that.
Thank you. So, I mean, yeah, at this was kind of a easy story. I don't want to say to pace, but to structure, because the premise is so simple that a lot of the legwork as far as writing goes went into the first couple pages just to set up the premise. Once I introduce the actors and what the actors are doing, they're just doing stuff for the rest of the issue. You know, it's very adventure-based, it's very action-based, it's kind of straightforward and is that concerned. So it kind of just – once I put all the pieces in place, it kind of just kind of flowed on its own, which I'm glad to hear that it was definitely the right choice. And issue two will probably launch in the summertime. I'm currently getting artwork for that and lettering it as it comes in. So yeah, I'm not a big fan of making people wait for them to finish the story. So yeah, I'm hoping that people like the way it ends.
So there's one part of your statement there that I have a hard time understanding, which is you found the structure somewhat easy. That part I believe, but the part that I'm struggling with is arriving at a two-issue structure, because that's not something we see very often in comics, and that alone intrigues me. What was it just – you had the story formed enough in your head to where that was just the natural length, or where did that choice come in?
I think it was more of a pragmatic choice as far as I'm one of these people that I'm sure a lot of creators are. As soon as they start writing comics, they want to start with their huge sixth issue magnus opus epic, and it didn't really work out the way I wanted it to. So I went back to basics the way everybody should and start with short stories, and I started creating an anthology, and then I went on to writing one-shots. And I'm slowly working my way up to now I'm doing two-part stories, which I think is a good I think 3 or 4 part miniseries is kind of the sweet spot, but a good 2-part story I think is very strong too. You know, especially when you're work collaborating with an artist, it's a continuation story, so it's not a single issue. You're dragging it along a little bit, so it's something leading into a second issue, but at the same time, it doesn't feel like it's out of reach. You know, it still seems doable in a reasonable time frame. So it wasn't a storytelling decision to make it two parts. It was kind of just that pragmatic choice of, we want something that's not going to be a one-off, but at the same time, it's not going to be such a huge commitment that we couldn't pull this off while working on other stuff.
I like it. I'm intrigued by it. And if I have a project that seems the right size for that, I might be inspired by your choice there and try it myself at some point.
Well, I plan on launching 4 campaigns in 2021 on 3 different projects, and they're all 2-port stories. So I'm really leaning into it heavy for this year, and I'll let you know how it goes.
Cool. So, you hinted a little bit about one of your previous projects. Let's talk about a few of your previous projects. The first one you mentioned, Macabre Motel. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the Macabre Motel was kind of a Twilight Zone, Are You Afraid of the Dark, or Outer Limits kind of inspired one shot that I did. That's just very simple premise. A guy stops to stay at a motel overnight and rest up before he continues on his journey in the morning. But it's filled with a whole bunch of weird, bizarre, creepy guests that kind of freak him out, and he has a real tough time leaving and getting out of there. You know, they kind of trap him there. So this was a very fun campaign. I had a blast doing it in October, perfect Halloween time. And it really resonated with people. I got a great response from it. And it's weird when you do something that's so bizarre and so out there. All these guests are so weird and so freaky. I had a really fun time just kind of coming up with random insane dialogue for them to say.
Okay.
And it's when you do something that's so surreal, it's like surrealist horror, you know? And when you do something that's strange, you never know how it's going to resonate with people. Mm-hmm. And people dug it. So I guess it was a risk worth taking there.
And the other project I was going to ask you about was an anthology, Modern Testament.
Yeah, Modern Testament was kind of the, when I talked about doing short stories going back to the beginning of my kind of comics writing career, Modern Testament was my baby. That was kind of my way of writing short, kind of could be 5, 8, 10-page stories, and I worked with a whole bunch of artists, and at the end, kind of came up with like 16 short stories, and this was my first Kickstarter campaign, was an anthology, an actual collection of all the stories. It was like 160 pages long or something. And that was kind of my first foray into my comics. It was kind of my comics boot camp in a way, because I wrote in so many different stories, so many different genres, with so many different art teams, that I really, it was a great experience just having all, because each short story was like a new project, you know, it's like I'm starting this from scratch, getting a team together and working on a totally new set of characters with a totally new story. So it was very cool to get all of those compiled into such a short period of time.
That does seem quite a brutal boot camp. That's almost like the Navy SEAL of comics boot camps right there.
It was a little bit, but you know, I look back on some of those stories and it's really cool to flip through the book and recall, you know, the experience I had with each different one, because it's not like one fluid experience from beginning to end. It was each its own little journey in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I want to circle back real quick on Macabre Motel. Is horror a genre that you are naturally a big fan of or are well-versed in creating or not?
I think I'm definitely a big horror guy. I love horror as a fan. I also think just horror in general is just a really fun genre. You know, just having the goal of to scare or to frighten. The Macabre Motel, I don't call it really gory horror. But the word people kept coming back to when reading it was, it was super unsettling, you know, which I think is was a very cool, I consider it a compliment, you know, to write a story that wasn't meant to really frighten people, but to unsettle them. And I thought that was great to hear. So yeah, I think horror is great. And there's so many different avenues of horror that you can kind of come at things from. You could do serial killers, or you could do supernatural horror, or you could do like something that's more of along the lines of environmental horror, you know, somebody stuck in a cave or something. So there's so many different ways to tell a horror story under that big umbrella.
I am going to temporarily steal some of your time here and press you a little bit further on this, because it just so happens I'm tipping my toes into the horror genre for the first time myself.
Ooh.
And I must confess, I hope this doesn't ruin any potential readership I may have on this project. I'm a bit new to it, and I'm not necessarily a routine connoisseur of the genre. I know it's a very popular genre in indie comics right now. And I'm a little confused. You called it fun, but at the root of comics, or at the root of horror, it's either going to scare you, make you fearful, and being scared and fearful doesn't seem fun to me. And it's going to put its characters through either intense physical pain or freak them out, and that's not fun. So Why should we seek this out in our leisure time as an avenue for quote unquote entertainment?
Millen, are you a horror fan? You're like, I'm taking this new endeavor, but it's torturous to write. I don't know why I'm doing this.
Actually, I'm finding it quite the opposite. Like, I was very trepidatious going in, but now that I've started, I've basically got the whole story mapped out, and I've got the first scene scripted, and it's a total pleasure. I'm loving it, and maybe this is a gear that I didn't realize that I might be able to drive in, but I still don't understand the genre yet.
So this is a very broad generalization. I don't want anybody to really take my words as golden here, but for the most part, what I've kind of understand that you see a lot of comedians, some of the funniest people in the world are the most tortured people behind the scenes, you know, their comedy comes from such a place of I don't want to say despair, but heartache, that they put on a face, they force themselves to be comedic because that's the only way to battle what's going on within them. And meanwhile, some of the people that make the goriest, meanest, most violent content you could ever imagine are some of the nicest and happiest people because they.
That is so true.
So I mean, it's just there's also, they've done studies that in times of political turmoil like now, that horror movies see a spike in popularity.
Really?
Yes.
That's interesting.
So people have studied this, and they find out that horror does well in times of turmoil. And there's something about taking all your anxieties, whether they're internal or external, and focusing them on a work of art and putting all that terror and all that anxiety and all that fear on the screen or on the page, that it's a stress reliever, you know, it's a form of therapy in a way. So just the ability as a writer to get all your darkest desires out into an imaginary setting is just a blast, you know.
Yeah. Do you have any insights or intuitions on, you know, even though you're in this sort of heightened realm of, and when you're doing horror, there is a sort of sweet spot, because when you're doing some sort of moment of violence or just creepiness, there's obviously some sort of invisible line that you can accidentally go over. And as someone who is as less well versed in the terrain as others, I'm a little trepidatious about. I think I'm probably going to overstep the lines a few times, and I need to figure out how to know where the lines are, and I don't know that yet.
I think if you're worried about stepping over the line, you're not really close to a line, to be honest with you.
Oh, really? Really?
You know, if you're that worried about where the line is, the people that go over the line don't even see lines. You know, they're just going full steam ahead. Just mm-hmm. So, I mean, for me personally, whether it's comedy or whether it's horror, the ultimate goal is not to make someone laugh or to scare someone. The ultimate goal is just to tell a good story. You know, if you tell a good story with those goals in mind, the terror and the fear will come later on. You know, they'll just come as naturally as part of the story. But if you try to force a situation in the story meant to scare someone, it's going to come off contrived and it's going to come off fake. You know, just tell a good story in a terrifying setting and just let the terror just come on its own.
That's good advice. Thank you. So we've talked a little bit about your present with Polar Paradox. We've talked a little bit about your past with Macabre Motel and Modern Testament. Let's speculate on some of your future. You've already got an ambitious year lined up. Is it premature to name any titles or give any sort of preview of what those are going to be like?
No. I have an email list I sent blasts out. So I told everybody what I'm kind of planning to hope and do for the year. So, my campaign schedule is probably going to be January is Polar Paradox. And then my next one will be in the spring. That will be a book called The Last Homicide, which is going to be like a crime detective mystery noirish kind of story, kind of like a throwback to the golden age of Hollywood, you know, Double Indemnity and Maltese Falcon, that kind of stuff.
I'm always game for that.
So it takes place in the modern setting, but it's definitely, it's a kind of a hard boiled pulp noir story. It's just about two detectives. They come across the premise is that on the eve of a detective's retirement, he comes across the murder of a mob boss's son. So he has to solve this last homicide before the two mobs start a gang war that kind of erupt in the city. So it's good. He's got to figure it out. So that should be a lot of fun. That's another, like I said, two-parter.
Yeah. Let me go ahead and insert the take my money now GIF right here. I like this one.
So, I mean, I find that a difficult genre to write, mainly because you can't rely on like an action scene to push the story forward, you know, to grab a viewer's attention. So it's not like Polar Paradox where they're diving and they're facing all these creatures underwater, or let's say a space thing where they have a big space sci-fi battle. This is definitely just a murder mystery where it's very story heavy, plot heavy, where they have to figure things out. So hopefully when people read it, they're not feeling bored and it's captivating them.
Excellent. And is that one also going to be a two-parter?
Yeah, that's a two-parter. That's spring, and then the summer will be the part two of the Polar Paradox. And then to wrap things up for my year, come the fall, hopefully again in October, I'm going to do like it's a kind of a, I don't want to call it a black comedy kind of horror story, but it's definitely a tongue-in-cheek kind of in-your-face horror, over the top horror, kind of like The Burbs, you know, that old Tom Hanks movie.
Yeah.
So, and the premise of that is two plumbers visit this old decrepit mansion, and they go into a basement, and they encounter this, let's just say it's a heavily Lovecraft inspired kind of adventure that they kind of go on, that they discover in the basement. So I kind of started this story under the working title like Lovecraft Plumbers. So that's just kind of how it goes on. And that book is called Pipe Creepers, which I think kind of sums up the overall tone.
Cool. Well, those sound very interesting. Yeah. Now let's play a hypothetical game. Let's say, Mr. or Mrs. Comics, whoever is in charge of the entire industry, knocks on your door one day and says, "Hello, I am Mrs. Comics. I am in charge of the entire comics industry. You can work on whatever licensed property you want. Is there one that entices you?"
Is there one that entices me? I would say the ultimate unattainable goal, I'll just say unattainable. My holy grail would be to do a run on Amazing Spider-Man. You know, I grew up, Spider-Man was my book. That's kind of the one book that no matter who's writing it or how bad I think it is, I'll always pick it up every month or every week. It seems that they're putting it out now. But as far as in the short term, what I would love to do, I mean, I would love to work on some other, I wouldn't call them B characters, but some kind of, you know, lesser known characters. I'm a big Man-Thing fan. I love to work on Man-Thing. I've always wanted to tell a tale in the back of my head I've had for Shocker, the Spider-Man villain. You know, I don't know. There's something about taking side characters that people know, but have never really had their time to shine in the spotlight, and kind of giving them that moment to have a story revolve around them. So I would kind of love those opportunities.
So in addition to getting whatever gig you want in the comics future, you also have the opportunity to reform certain aspects of the industry with this hypothetical. What are some things you'd like to see change in the industry in general?
That's a loaded question.
Yes, indeed. And I advise you to avoid it as much as possible.
You know what? One thing that's always bothered me about comics, and this will never change, but temporary deaths, you know, I don't think that will ever change, just because these IPs are so popular. They've been around for so long that everybody's going to eventually come back. But I would love to see an instance where either Marvel or DC promoted an event with a character who dies and it's a permanent death, you know? It's like there's no coming back for this person. I don't know what they would do to make that kind of foolproof, whether or not they would sell off the rights or something to the characters so that they can never make a story with them again. But yeah, I don't know. There's something hollow about character death that just doesn't have any emotional weight to them. You know, not that I haven't read any comic stories with any emotional weight. It's just that it's like everything eventually returns to the status quo. So I really feel that any death is just kind of like, okay, let's get to the end of the story, and then 6 months down the line when they come back. So,
right. So I've got just a couple of questions to wrap up here. We've got a standard question that we ask on the program of everybody. What's on your radar these days? What's on your cultural radar? What are you reading or watching that you can recommend?
I'm watching pretty much whatever everybody else is watching. You know, Cobra Kai, I just finished watching it with my wife. I think season 3 was phenomenal. I really dug it. You know what's cool about Cobra Kai is that do you watch the show?
I do. I love it, but I just recently did a major life event moving. So, I only just got to start it yesterday. So, I'm only one episode in.
Oh, for the season 3?
For season 3, yes.
So I think Cobra Kai is like it's a masterclass in tone. You know, it really hits that sweet spot of tone where you can have gigantic karate battles, and then you can have really heartfelt moments, and then really silly comedy. You know, it's really hard to find a tone for a story that balances and juggles all of those. So I think they do a really good job of accomplishing all those things and yet not overplaying its hand on any of them.
I agree, and I'm so glad to hear that season 3 continues to hold up. That's great to hear.
I mean, I've seen more people posting mixed results about it than the other two, but I dug it. I really liked it. What else am I watching? I'm watching. My wife likes watching the Sabrina on Netflix. The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think that's on its final season. Oh, you know what's coming back that we both really loved was Snowpiercer, the TV show on TNT. So, are you familiar with that show?
I read the comic and saw the movie. How far along are they on the show?
This will be season 2 that's coming up.
Okay.
So, and it was very bizarre because they showed season 1 this past summer. And then as soon as the season finale ended, they started with a preview, a commercial for season 2. And I'm like, I've never seen a show wrap up and then they immediately go into an advertisement for the second season. Like they already filmed it like back to back or something, which I thought was kind of interesting. I've never seen the movie. I've never had any other experience with it other than the show. But I think it was when it was airing, it was kind of the show that I was looking forward to every week. You know, I'm a big DVR guy. I love DVRing things and then watching them at my leisure. But when a show really hooks me, I can tell because I watch it as soon as it's on. Like I wait 10 minutes and I'm like, okay, let's go into it.
Cool. Well, Frank, thank you so much for coming on to the show. Just so that everyone else can know, I think we'll put this in the show notes, but just in case, where can we find you on social media?
Real simple. I'm Frank the Writer, so you can find me frankthewriter.com. Also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. My handle for all three is @FrankTheWriter.
Cool. This is very memorable. Well, thank you so much for coming along, and best of luck on Polar Paradox and all of your other projects you have lined up for 2021.
You too, Milton. Thank you so much. And hopefully you definitely get in that horror rhythm and enjoy. I don't know what it's about, but hopefully you find some place to chop somebody up in that story.
All right. I will do my best and I'll take your advice. Well, thanks so much, dude.
You too.